In the World Service of the BBC, this is Max Pearson with NewsHour. ...60 minutes of news, analysis and comment from around the world. Hello, the headlines today. The Hong Kong government says it's to carry out a mass slaughter of chickens to try to stamp out a virulent new form of influenza known as bird flu. Hong Kong's director of health says the slaughter is needed after the virus was identified at a poultry market and on a local farm. It's the last day of campaigning in Kenya.
I'm Greg Barrow in the Kenyan capital, Nairobi, and later in this programme, I'll be bringing you news of the country's presidential and parliamentary elections, with less than 24 hours before polling begins.
A court in Egypt has upheld a ban on female genital mutilation. Live from Cairo, we hear the reaction from one of the country's leading gynecologists. Zimbabwe's white farmers had until today to register their objection to having their farms taken over for redistribution to the poor. The former Prime Minister Ian Smith tells us why he's staying put.
There were a quarter of a million black people in this country. There are now over 12 million. Why? Because the white man came and stopped them killing one another and dying of disease. Should we be blamed for that?
Also today... From Rome, the quiet religious community working to solve some of the world's most intractable conflicts. The news today is read by Vicky Marriott.
The authorities in Hong Kong say there will be a mass slaughter of chickens in an effort to stamp out the virulent new form of influenza known as bird flu. An official said that more than a million chickens would be killed and burned. The flu, which is thought to be spread through direct contact with chickens, has killed three people and been linked to a fourth death. From Hong Kong, Jill McGivering reports.
The slaughter of an estimated 1.25 million chickens in Hong Kong will begin on Monday and is expected to take about 24 hours. As well as chickens on local farms, all live poultry in wholesale markets and retail stores will also be killed, including those in outlying areas of Hong Kong raised by smallholders for their own consumption. The decision was taken after a local farm and a wholesale market were declared infected areas early on Sunday. Tests were carried out there after the deaths of many chickens were reported, and the bird flu virus H5N1 was found to be present. Officials said the slaughter would be followed by a comprehensive cleansing operation.
And we'll be hearing more from Jill McGivering after this bulletin. The highest administrative court in Egypt, the Council of State, has upheld an official ban on female genital mutilation in the country. In June, a lower court lifted the health ministry's ban on the practice, also known as female circumcision, in response to a lawsuit brought by Islamists. They had argued that the state could not forbid female circumcision because it was required under Islamic law. However, the health ministry appealed against the decision. Official statistics show that more than 90% of women in Egypt are circumcised. A Protestant paramilitary group in Northern Ireland, whose leader was killed in prison yesterday, says it was responsible for the shooting dead last night of a hotel security guard. In a statement, the Protestant group, the Loyalist Volunteer Force, warned of more attacks on Catholic targets to avenge the death of its leader, Billy Wright. This report from Maurice Walsh.
The authorities in Northern Ireland had feared that the gun attack outside a crowded hotel frequented by Roman Catholics in the town of Dungannon was a direct reprisal for the killing of the Protestant paramilitary leader Billy Wright. One man died and three other people, including a 14-year-old boy, were seriously wounded after masked gunmen opened fire indiscriminately outside the hotel. Not only did Mr. Wright's associates confirm that revenge was the motive, but they also threatened that there would be similar attacks in the future. Further violence could undermine the peace negotiations, which are edging towards a settlement. The British government minister responsible for Northern Ireland, Mo Molum, said the province faced a dangerous and testing time.
Candidates in Kenya's presidential and parliamentary elections are holding a final day of campaigning before the vote on Monday. Several of the presidential candidates, including the incumbent head of state, Daniel Arap Moi, are holding rallies. Two national newspapers which support the ruling KANU party carry details of an independent election poll predicting that Mr. Moi will be returned to power. Kathy Jenkins reports from Nairobi.
Kenya's election candidates have been given an extra day to campaign after an announcement that today would no longer be an official breathing space before the people go to the polls. The main presidential candidates were all due to hold rallies, although those held over the past few days have been relatively muted affairs. Whilst the level of violence over the campaign period has been far lower than in 1992, there's also been a marked lack of euphoria. In many places, including Nairobi, only a few campaign posters strung across roads indicate that an election is here. On the eve of the poll, the presidential candidates once again took out full-page advertisements in a national newspaper, urging people to vote for them. Those taken out by President Moi's ruling party KANU were in colour, the others in black and white, one reflection of the way KANU has been able to draw on much bigger campaign funds than anyone else.
The deadline expires in Zimbabwe today for white farmers to submit their objections to having their farms taken away from them and resettled by landless peasants. The government has earmarked 1,500 farms for nationalisation. Compensation will be paid only for infrastructure improvements, not for the land itself. BBC World Service. Now back to Max Pearson.
Thanks, Vicky. Fear surrounding the Hong Kong bird flu has prompted the authorities there into more drastic action. A mass slaughter of chickens is to start tomorrow. More than a million birds from 1,000 markets and stalls are to be killed and then burned. So far, there have been only 4 deaths and around 20 confirmed cases of infection with the new strain of flu, known as H5N1. But public anxiety is running high. Dr. Margaret Chan is Director of Health in Hong Kong.
In the light of new evidence, the government has decided, in public health interest, to kill birds, that means chicken, in all local farms. And at the retail level, because it is very difficult to say whether a cross-infection has occurred between chicken, duck, geese, and other poultry like pigeon or quail, because they are kept in very close proximity.
Dr. Margaret Chan, well, our correspondent in Hong Kong is Jill McGivering. I asked her if the mass slaughter plan is a sign of panic.
I think the authorities would say that it's not so much panic as that they're trying to be seen to take a comprehensive measure. There is enormous concern in Hong Kong. People are flocking to local hospitals and so on to try and get tests because they're concerned they might be contracting this flu. People are now not buying chickens. So they feel if they make a once and for all gesture to basically get rid of the livestock, disinfect and start again, this may solve the problem, at least in the short term.
But it also seems to illustrate that they're not entirely sure, because they can't focus down any narrower than this, where the flu bug is in the chicken chain, so to speak.
It's extremely difficult for them to find that out. I mean, basically, there is a lot of movement of chickens from farms to markets and so on. And chickens here, when they are stored and moved, tend to be in very close, cramped conditions. So one of the main concerns is that there may be a lot of cross-contamination going on that they're not able to detect until symptoms actually emerge.
Do the authorities yet know what part of the bird is dangerous? Is it in the gut? Is it in the meat? Is it in the feathers or what?
They are repeatedly saying that the meat itself is safe, and certainly the one thing that they've said right from the beginning is that cooked chicken doesn't pose a hazard. In terms of the preparation of chicken, there is concern that if the virus is being transmitted through chicken, live chickens, it's probably through the gut, the intestine, possibly through excrement. And so if you were handling chickens, if you were cleaning them, or if a child was playing around a chicken farm where children may be, you know, playing in the debris, in feathers, it would be possible that infection could be passed on in that way.
Is there any danger then from the process of slaughtering and burning? Will this have to be done in carefully controlled conditions?
Absolutely. Yes, they're making clear that they're going to be issuing very specific guidelines to the workers who are going to be involved in carrying out this vast operation. They're saying that the chickens will be killed through, they will basically be gassed through carbon dioxide. They will then be sealed in plastic bags and taken through in a supervised and controlled way to landfills where they will be burned. So they are very keen to make sure that the carcasses aren't still available in the environment to be able to reinfect in any way.
Jill McGivering in Hong Kong. Even at this time of year, the season of Christmas, it's hard to escape images of war and ethnic conflict. Every other day, television seems to bring pictures of the latest atrocities from war zones across the globe. In many, the international community is trying to mediate solutions. But these high-profile efforts aren't the only attempts being made to solve some of the world's most intractable conflicts. As Orla Guerin reports from Rome, there are others working behind the scenes, like the Sant'Egidio community, who are achieving some extraordinary results.
Morning Mass in one of Rome's most beautiful churches, Santa Maria in Trastevere. It's the kind of place where you might expect to find members of a Catholic lay community, and they're here, but that's only part of their story. Some members of the community of Sant'Egidio lead double lives. They have day jobs in everything from computers to television, but are also highly effective, if little known, international mediators. Theirs is a low-key brand of peacemaking.
We don't want to become a prima donna of mediation, you know? We work only where we think or other people think that we are useful, that our presence is useful.
Dr. Fabio Riccardi, one of Sant'Egidio's team of hidden mediators. All are volunteers. He's a family man working in medical research who helped bring peace to Mozambique. The Mozambican Peace Accord was signed in Sant'Egidio in 1992 after 2 years of talks there. These days, one of the key worries for mediators like Fabio Riccardi is Burundi. Sant'Egidio is trying to find a solution there before it's too late.
We know what happened in Rwanda, and unfortunately, Burundi is running the same risk. So we are trying to avoid such a risk for them. So I think that the work of facilitating a peaceful convivence between Hutu community and Tutsi community is a priority for us.
No one expects a quick fix for Burundi, but the community has had some success. With the help of Sant'Egidio, Hutu and Tutsi leaders agreed an agenda for future discussions in March of this year. Their talks were held, as many others have been, behind closed doors at Sant'Egidio's headquarters. It's tucked away in a popular square in the heart of Rome. Crowds sing the Alleluia at an evening service of music and prayer at the community's headquarters. It's usually a case of standing room only. The night of my visit, a former Italian president was there with his bodyguards. Among the congregation, his head bowed in prayer, was Mario Marazziti, another of Sant'Egidio's unlikely mediators. By day, he's a senior manager in Rai, Italian state television. Having been involved in peace efforts all over the globe, he believes Sant'Egidio's slimline operation, without powerful backers, has its advantages.
I think that as a non-governmental organization, Sant'Egidio has some weaknesses that can become also points of strength. For example, not having any vested interest or direct interest, economical interest in an area, Sant'Egidio can be trusted, even if we have no instruments of pressure, of economical pressure.
In 1998, the lay community of Sant'Egidio will be 30 years old. Since its establishment, it has been fighting war and poverty without fanfare or frills. The community has no staff, just volunteers. Donations provide most of its funding. But its steady, quiet diplomacy has succeeded where others have failed. The only problem now, the community says, is that there are too many conflicts around the world which could use its help.
Orla Guerin reporting from Rome. It's 13:14 GMT. In a moment, live from Egypt, reaction to the latest court ruling there banning female circumcision. You're listening to the BBC's World Service. This is Max Pearson with NewsHour. Main news today, the Hong Kong government says it's to carry out a mass slaughter of chickens to try to stamp out a virulent new form of influenza known as bird flu. Final campaigning has been taking place in Kenya ahead of tomorrow's presidential and parliamentary elections. Greg Barrow is in Kenya for NewsHour and he joins us now. Greg.
I'm at All Saints Cathedral in the centre of Nairobi, where campaigning is reaching its climax on the day before Kenya's presidential and parliamentary elections. There's a mood of anticipation ahead of the polls, but in keeping with the traditions of this largely Christian nation, Sunday is a day of worship and the churches are full. The church has, of course, played a prominent role in putting pressure on the government to improve its human rights record, root out corruption, and allow democracy to flourish here in Kenya. At times, church and state have come into open conflict. Earlier this year, an opposition protest spilled into All Saints Cathedral, and police fired tear gas into the cathedral building. But the church here cherishes its role in guiding its congregation, and today is no different to any other day.
Tomorrow is the time that you must take the opportunity and go to vote.
There are plenty of young people among the congregation today, and it's of course they who really count. I'm joined by Nelly, Enos and Joshua, all young voters, and some of whom will be voting for the first time in these upcoming elections. Enos, first of all, what are your feelings ahead of the vote?
Well, I feel that currently we are pretty more mature than what we were in 1992. Well, there's no euphoria, there's no excitement. We now are level-headed. We know what we want to do and how we can get that.
What about you, Nelly? You'll be voting for the very first time in these elections. You must be at least a little bit excited about what's going to happen.
I'm quite excited because this is my first time to vote and a bit apprehensive because I still do not know who I'm voting in for. My main concern is actually for the presidential candidate because there are so many right now and it's a bit mind-boggling as to who we should be choosing in.
Joshua, is it confusing that we've got so many candidates, 15 candidates this time, more than twice as many as 1992?
The candidates are many, but I don't really think all of them are really qualified enough to lead this country, and by qualified I mean capable enough. I'm looking for a track record, a good track record. I'm looking for ability to lead people, to organize people. I'm looking for someone who has this country in heart and not just themselves or some other thing they want to bring out to the front.
It goes down to around three or four only. No, the rest are just saying one and the same thing. Nobody's come up with the original ideas, new things to tell us, but things he can do for this country. They're all doing the same thing. They're saying the same thing, and we are tired, you know.
Those are the views from some of the congregation, and with me now is the Very Reverend Peter Njoka, who's the provost of All Saints Cathedral. He's been an influential campaigner in Kenya's push for democratic and constitutional reform. And on more than one occasion, I think you've been caught up in various confrontations between the church and the government. But can I just start by asking you, Provost, how optimistic are you about these coming elections compared to those held 5 years ago in 1992?
By your standards, I am very optimistic, simply because now it appears the opposition has accepted to go to the polls, even though they are fragmented. They have accepted to go to the polls and they stand a chance, not so much of winning, as of being a great influence in the government that is to come.
What kind of advice have you been giving to members of your congregation about just how they should conduct themselves in these elections?
I've often told my members of this cathedral to be wary of bribes, never to accept any campaign money, but never to be cowed about voting. They should go to the polls as Christians and they should vote for a person they consider, in their view, is the person espousing the values they as Christians consider best for this country.
Now you and other church leaders have been fairly outspoken in the months and years leading up to this election about some of the leaders of this country. Do you feel that the government and the president have also been listening to what you've been saying and acting upon it? Have you seen a substantial change in the way things are now as a result of some of the things that you have been raising as the church in Kenya?
We as church leaders are feeling encouraged. We are feeling encouraged because people have accepted to go to the polls, the government accepted to register all the political parties, those which requested for registering, and whether that is a campaign to fragment the opposition, but they have accepted what we were asking for.
But just in the last 24 hours, the National Council of Churches of Kenya and a number of other church groups have issued a statement saying that they are seriously concerned about vote rigging, corruption in the electoral process, an element of intimidation. Does that actually make you perhaps a little bit worried about how the process is going to go on?
Every church leader is worried about the events that are going on. In Embu, yesterday, the Roman Catholic Bishop of Embu showed the press two voting cans, one which had already been stamped, meaning that the person had already voted. So these are some of the worrying factors in this election. But we are seeing as churches that if we are going to detect any form of rigging, we are going to tell the nation and the world at large, we are not accepting the results of this election.
That was the very Reverend Peter Njoka with perhaps a fair reflection of voters' thoughts, some guarded optimism, but a real realization that there are still problems with this electoral process. Now over to you, Max, in the studio in London.
Thanks, Greg. Don't go away, though, because just before you go, what is the latest news from the campaigning today? I mean, is it a foregone conclusion that Daniel Arap Moi is going to win the presidency because the opposition is simply so divided?
Well, certainly the opposition isn't treating it as a foregone conclusion. They've been winding up their campaigning over the last few hours. This is the last day of official campaigning. And there's a real party atmosphere at some of these campaigns. People are dancing, some of them are a little bit drunk. There's a lot of happiness, and there is a little bit of violence on the fringes in some cases. But they really want to take this to the wire. Although they've heard a lot of reports and a lot of opinion polls that suggest that Daniel Arap Moi is going to walk this one again, they're not giving up yet.
What, though, will be the reaction from the opposition if that turns out to be the case, coupled with the fact that there have been these allegations of vote buying and so forth? Is the opposition going to feel cheated?
I think they will feel cheated because they're on a bit of a roll. They're enjoying the process at the moment, and I think they believe their own publicity in a way. So perhaps come a week from now when they realise that they haven't got into power again, there is going to be a certain amount of disgruntled people around. There is a possibility of violence. Certainly a few shopkeepers I've spoken to here in Nairobi have been saying that they intend to shut up shop for a few days after the election because they don't want to be involved in anything that might blow up on the streets. Certainly they'll be protesting to Western missions and other diplomats about what they see as rigging, intimidation and buying of votes. But really, They'll have to accept it if it's a countrywide victory, and they'll have to look to the next election for their next campaign.
That's all a bit early, perhaps, to be saying that. But Greg Barrow, live from Nairobi, thanks very much indeed for joining us. The highest court in Egypt has upheld the ban on female circumcision. The case came before the Council of State after a lower court had lifted the health ministry's ban on the grounds that female circumcision is required under Islamic law. This issue has pitted the more secular elements of the government against the Islamists. Government figures show that more than 90% of Egyptian women have been circumcised. Many international organizations condemn the practice as genital mutilation. Mohamed Abdul Ghar is professor of gynecology at Cairo University. He has campaigned against female circumcision, and he's on the line now. First of all, your reaction to the verdict of the Council of State?
Well, I am very happy with this verdict because I think this represents the right direction.
But there is popular support for the practice. I mean, simply banning it at an official level through the courts is not going to eradicate it, surely?
No, it's not going to eradicate it, but it is a very important step towards eradicating it.
because people, they do it out of habit. And if there is a good campaign and proper education, the procedure will be less and less.
But you're saying they do it out of habit, but if more than 90% of Egyptian women have been circumcised, that seems to show that there is more than simply habitual support for the practice.
It's definitely not religious support. It is generations after generations, and it is a sort of a tradition, that's all. And it's clear that when the level of education is a little bit higher, then the percentage of circumcised girls in these families is very, very low.
Isn't there a danger, though, that a ban at an official level will simply drive women into the arms of potentially dangerous, unhygienic backstreet practitioners?
Not at all, because actually it was legal thing is only something of a moral thing, because it was never really practiced in the hospitals. It is always being done, the operation, on by small nurses or midwives, or it was never done. So the issue was sort of on the morals of it. Is it legal or not?
So it's always been in the back streets?
Yes, it has always been in the back streets.
And from your experience, what are the more painful repercussions of this practice?
Well, for the practice, of course, the worst thing is the mutilation of the female genital tract, and that the woman is not going to have the normal feelings in her future sexual life. And also the feeling of inferiority, because why this practice should be only done for women?
Mohammed Abdul Gar, Professor of Gynecology at Cairo University. Britain is still trying to honour one of Russia's leading generals for his role during the Second World War. The British Defence Secretary, George Robertson, has written to the widow of Marshal Ivan Konev on what would have been his 100th birthday. It was Marshal Konev, who died in 1973, who led the Russian forces during the decisive Battle of Kursk in the 1943 campaign against Hitler's troops on the steppe front. John Erickson is Professor of Russian Politics at Edinburgh University.
Konev really stands out as one of the most distinguished front commanders. In other words, in terms of, if you like, the role of distinction of Red Army, Soviet Army commanders, first of all, there's Marshal Zhukov, then there's Marshal Rokossovsky, then comes Marshal Konev.
Why, though, did he refuse Britain's attempts to honour him at the end of the war?
Well, there are two reasons for that. First of all, Marshal Zhukov and Marshal Rokossovsky were honoured in Berlin when Field Marshal Montgomery gave them their decorations and Knight Commanders of the Order of the Bath. But Marshal Konev, who had taken part in the storming of Berlin, in fact had been diverted by Stalin to Prague with his front in order to liberate Prague. So Marshal Konev was not present in Berlin in order to receive his decoration. And in fact, in 1946, as a protest, I think one can say that, at Prime Minister Churchill's Fulton speech, Marshal Konev refused his decoration, and in 1949 there is a note in the records of St. James's Palace saying, recipient not available to receive. So there's a certain amount of confusion about that, but clearly Konev, both as I think as a political gesture and very possibly as a personal gesture, turned down the decoration immediately after the war.
And then subsequently the Iron Curtain came down and there was no way of getting a medal to him, even if he'd wanted to take it.
Well, I presume he didn't want to take it. What has happened is it's simply after the collapse of the Soviet Union, and indeed the inquiries of his widow, which is, first of all, we had to discover precisely what decoration Marshal Konev had received, and secondly, where, in fact, the attestations and indeed the proclamations were. That was very, I must say, very expertly uncovered by St. James's Palace, and it was certainly determined that Marshal Konev had been awarded an honorary Knight Commander of the Order of the Bath.
Do we know what sort of an individual he was and what he would have made of this this continued effort to honor him so long after his death?
Well, I knew Marshal Konev and spent quite a long time with him, actually. He was a fairly brusque person. He was, in fact, I think, very conscious of his dignity and very conscious of his role. And indeed, in exchanges both with Marshal Konev and indeed with other Soviet commanders, they placed a very high price on these decorations. They were regarded as being symbolically and personally very important. And I think that the gesture that Marshal Konev made in refusing it was obviously very important to him.
Professor John Erickson from Edinburgh University. It's nearly 13:30 GMT. In a moment, Ian Smith on why he and other white farmers in Zimbabwe are staying put. And as the year draws to a close, one of the most historic moments of 97. We remember the handback of Hong Kong. You're listening to the BBC's World Service. This is Max Pearson with NewsHour. First, though, a summary of the latest world news from Vicky Marriott.
A mass slaughter of more than a million chickens is to take place in Hong Kong in an attempt to stop a virulent new form of influenza known as bird flu. The virus has so far killed four people and infected about 20 others. A top Egyptian court has upheld an official ban on female genital mutilation, also known as female circumcision. A lower court had earlier lifted the government ban in response to a lawsuit brought by a group of Islamists. They'd argued that female circumcision was required under Islamic law. A Protestant paramilitary group in Northern Ireland, whose leader was killed in prison yesterday, says it was responsible for the shooting death last night of a hotel security guard. The guard was killed and three others were wounded outside a hotel used mostly by Roman Catholics. The final day of campaigning is being held in Kenya ahead of presidential and parliamentary elections on Monday. Health service workers in Israel are holding a one-day strike to protest at plans to cut back levels of cover in state health insurance. Public hospitals were hit as doctors and nurses stayed away. And police in Sri Lanka say a bomb explosion in the south of the country, just outside a navy base, was a suicide attack by Tamil Tiger rebels. They say the blast may have been an assassination attempt on the Sri Lankan navy chief. And that's the summary, Max.